Welcome. Moving into chapter 10, the three modes of nature, which was an article Sri Aurobindo first published in the Arya on the 15th of September, 1915, substantially revised, of course, around 1932, and touched upon again in the early 40s, we guess. Now, as he has revised the chapters that we've looked at so far, he's inserted breaks in the flow of his argument. Sometimes those breaks are far apart, and sometimes they're close upon each other. We thought of when best to talk about the Sankhya system and its philosophy. And I think rather than do it tonight, we'll read through to the break and talk about the Sankhya system before our next session a week from today. We'll touch upon some things as we go, but mostly tonight we're going to read the beautiful language of Sri Aurobindo. Chapter 10, The Three Modes of Nature. To transcend the natural action of the lower prakriti is indispensable to the soul if it is to be free in itself and free in its works. Harmonious subjection to this actual universal nature, a condition of good and perfect work for the natural instruments, is not an ideal for the soul, which should rather be subject to God and his Shakti, but master of its own nature. As agent, or as channel of the supreme will, it must determine by its vision and sanction or refusal the use that shall be made of the storage of energy, the conditions of environment, the rhythm of combined movement which are provided by prakriti for the labor of the natural instruments, mind, life, and body. But this inferior nature can only be mastered if she is surmounted and used from above. And this can only be done by a transcendence of her forces, qualities, and modes of action. Otherwise, we are subject to her conditions and helplessly dominated by her, not free in the spirit. So already he's alluded to conclusions that Sankhya has reached, that if we attempt to achieve the perfection of the elements of our nature according to their own structure, according to the qualities that are embedded in them, then it will always be imperfect and is not sufficient even if you take it to its utmost. The balance that nature can achieve is not conditioned on the nature of the divine conscious power. Rather, it is conditioned on the elements of ignorance, ordinary nature. So, Sri Aurobindo says, for the soul, it can't be subject to nature. For it to achieve sovereignty, it means that it must transcend, it must overtop nature, and use nature as if from above. Read it again. But this inferior nature can only be mastered if she is surmounted and used from above. So it isn't that it's going to be extirpated, that the gunas, as we'll come to see, are going to be eradicated. It isn't that prakriti is going to be somehow got rid of, but the higher nature must descend into the lower. There must be a union of the two in some sense, But until you get the transcendence, no union can be effected. No descent of the higher nature can come until one has transcended the lower nature. Then one can find the enginery by which the higher descends. So first one must be free. The idea of the three essential modes of nature is a creation of the ancient Indian thinkers, and its truth is not at once obvious because it was the result of long psychological experiment and profound internal experience. Therefore, without a long inner experience, without intimate self-observation and intuitive perception of the nature forces, it is difficult to grasp accurately or firmly utilize. Still, certain broad indications may help the seeker on the way of works to understand, analyze, and control by his assent or refusal the combinations of his own nature. These modes are termed in the Indian books qualities, gunas, and are given the names sattva, rajas, tamas. Sattva is the force of equilibrium and translates in quality as good and harmony and happiness and light. Rajas is the force of kinesis and translates in quality as struggle and effort, passion and action. Tamas is the force of inconscience and inertia and translates in quality as obscurity and incapacity and inaction. Ordinarily used for psychological self-analysis, these distinctions are valid also in physical nature. Each thing and every existence in the lower prakriti contains them, and its process and dynamic form are the result of the interaction of these qualitative powers. Now again, next week we'll talk about this a good bit more, look at some of the actual history involved and how it developed from one phase of interpretation of nature to another. But this should be seen straightforwardly, that what is true of the individual is also true of the cosmic. That whether we're talking about a person's combined nature, that he has a mind like this, an emotional being like that, and a physical body that looks like this, all three are combinations of all of these gunas. There is no particle in the physical universe, in the mental or emotional worlds, that is not constructed of all the gunas. One may dominate, but all are continually present. It is impossible to have a formation in nature, says the Sankhya, without all three gunas being present. You don't get two and the third is absent. You don't get just one. All three are always present. This is also true of the cosmic picture. What is true of the individual is true of the universe. Every form of things, whether animate or inanimate, is a constantly maintained poise of natural forces in motion and is subject to an unending stream of helpful, disturbing, or disintegrating contacts from other combinations of forces that surround it. Very much like Heraclitus, the world is constantly in motion. Things are in collision, come into being, continue for a while, and pass out of being. Our own nature of mind, life, and body is nothing else than such a formative combination and poise. in the reception of the environing contacts and the reaction to them, the three modes determine the temper of the recipient and the character of the response. Inert and inapt, he may suffer them without any responsive reaction, any motion of self-defense, or any capacity of assimilation and adjustment. This is the mode of tamas, the way of inertia. The stigmata of tamas are blindness and unconsciousness and incapacity and unintelligence, sloth and indolence and inactivity and mechanical routine and the mind's torpor and the life's sleep and the soul's slumber. Its effect, if uncorrected by other elements, can be nothing but disintegration of the form or the poise of the nature, without any new creation or new equilibrium or force of kinetic progress. At the heart of this inert impotence is the principle of ignorance and an inability or slothful unwillingness to comprehend, seize, and manage the stimulating or assailing contact, the suggestion of environing forces, and their urge towards fresh experience. So, all in nature, everything that we know is the formation of prakriti. We know nothing else until we have come to see what we are as the purusha, as the witness, as the free soul. All that we experience and all that we know is nature, is prakriti. And this is the first element that he discusses, the very foundation, tamas. On the other hand, the recipient of nature's contacts, touched and stimulated, solicited or assailed by her forces, may react to the pressure or against it. She allows, encourages, impels him to strive, to resist, to attempt, to dominate or engross his environment, to assert his will, to fight and create and conquer. This is the mode of rajas, the way of passion and action and the thirst of desire. Struggle and change and new creation, victory and defeat and joy and suffering and hope and disappointment are its children, and build the many-colored house of life in which it takes its pleasure. But its knowledge is an imperfect or a false knowledge, and brings with it ignorant effort, error, a constant misadjustment, pain of attachment, disappointed desire, grief of loss, and failure. The gift of rajas is kinetic force, energy, activity, the power that creates and acts and can overcome. But it moves in the wrong lights, or the half-lights of the ignorance. And it is perverted by the touch of the asura, rakshasa, and pishacha. The arrogant ignorance of the human mind and its self-satisfied perversions and presumptuous errors, the pride and vanity and ambition, the cruelty and tyranny and beast wrath and violence, the selfishness and baseness and hypocrisy and treachery and vile meanness, the lust and greed and rapacity, the jealousy, envy, and bottomless ingratitude that disfigure the earth nature are the natural children of this indispensable but strong and dangerous turn of nature. I'm tempted to pause for a minute and note that Sri Aurobindo had spoken about how the entire vital world, dominated by rajas, had descended to prevent the supramental advent, and in its coming has imposed upon earth life the vices of its temperament. There's a list. There is a solution. Even one available within manifold nature. But the embodied being is not limited to these two modes of prakriti. There is a better and more enlightened way in which he can deal with surrounding impacts and the stream of the world forces. There is possible a reception and reaction with clear comprehension, poise, and balance. This way of natural being has the power that, because it understands, sympathizes. It fathoms and controls and develops nature's urge and her ways. It has an intelligence that penetrates her processes and her significances and can assimilate and utilize. There is a lucid response that is not overpowered, but adjusts, corrects, adapts, harmonizes, elicits the best in all things. This is the mode of sattva, the turn of nature that is full of light and poise, directed to good, to knowledge, to delight and beauty, to happiness, right understanding, right equilibrium, right order. Its temperament is the opulence of a bright clearness of knowledge and a lucent warmth of sympathy and closeness, a fineness and enlightenment, a governed energy, an accomplished harmony and poise of the whole being is the consummate achievement of the sattvic nature. And of course, we see in the Bhagavad Gita, especially in the 17th chapter, a listing of these various qualities and an encouragement that Krishna gives to Arjuna to live from the sattvic nature, to impose the principle of light more and more on what begin as unwilling members dominated by tamas, inertia, and rajas, passion, but with the effort, with the application of the will, which is itself an element of the enlightening sattvic nature, you begin to impose a growing harmony on the being. This can, of course, mean that one has to accept as a half stage, as a way station on the way, the perfection possible to nature in order to overachieve it, to overstep it, to ascend to a higher nature. So, sattvicization is not itself liberation, but tends towards the light in the natural realm of things. So the Gita commends that to our action in Sri Aurobindo seconds. But back to the nature of nature, no existence is cast entirely in the single mold of any of these three modes of the cosmic force. All three are present in everyone and everywhere. There is a constant combining and separation of their shifting relations and interpenetrating influences, often a conflict, a wrestling of forces, a struggle to dominate each other. All have, in great or in small extent or degree, even if sometimes in a hardly appreciable minimum, their sattvic states and clear tracks or inchoate tendencies of light, clarity, and happiness, fine adaptation and sympathy with the environment, intelligence, poise, right mind, right will and feeling, right impulse, virtue, order. All have their rajasic moods and impulses, and turbid parts of desire and passion and struggle, perversion and falsehood and error, unbalanced joy and sorrow, aggressive push to work and eager creation and strong or bold or fiery or fierce reactions to the pressure of the environment and to life's assaults and offers. All have their tamasic states and constant obscure parts, their moments or points of unconsciousness, their long habit or their temporary velleities of weak resignation or dull acceptance, their constitutional feeblenesses or movements of fatigue, negligence and indolence, and their lapses into ignorance and incapacity, depression and fear and cowardly recoil or submission to the environment or and to the pressure of men and events and forces. Each one of us is sattvic in some directions of his energy of nature, or in some parts of his mind, or character. In others, rajasic, tamasic in others. According as one or other of the modes usually dominates his general temperament and type of mind and turn of action, it is said of him that he is the sattvic, the rajasic, or the tamasic man. But few are always of one kind, and none is entire in his kind. The wise are not always or wholly wise. The intelligent are intelligent only in patches. The saint suppresses in himself many unsaintly movements, and the evil are not entirely evil. The dullest has his unexpressed or unused and undeveloped capacities, the most timorous his moments or his way of courage, the helpless and the weakling a latent part of strength in his nature. The dominant gunas are not the essential soul type of the embodied being, but only the index of the formation he has made for this life or during his present existence and at a given moment of his evolution in time. So we've come to the break. We should note here that Sri Aurobindo spoke of his own being in ways that accord with what is written here. When he began to practice yoga, and he had this great realization of Brahman, he still had what he felt to be a weak and small vital nature, more tamasic than not. When he came to Pondicherry and took that place as his cave of tapasya and began to develop what we call the integral yoga, he found the means by which, through the application of his will, he could expand and greaten the vital nature until it became conterminous with the universe. It became very large. And one could feel the force of Sri Aurobindo's vital presence far away. In fact, Mother spoke about feeling the shock of his subtle physical being, but too, she recognized the enormity of the vital power that was stored in him. So it didn't simply become rajasic, but some divine conversion was occurring in him because he found that initial freedom from subjection to nature and no longer identified with the prakriti of his being. So that silent and as a witness, and then as Anumantra, as the one who imposes sanction. He chose to draw energies and light from above and bring them down into his being, and step by step to expand. So his yoga was a laboratory in which he was testing these theories of whether we can contact the higher nature, para prakriti, the chit shakti, and draw it down into the physical, the vital, and the mental being so far as they could accept. He took his time. Sometimes he would move a little more quickly than nature could permit, and there would be a relapse back to an old condition. Nature is gravid and seeks its former empire if it feels unsure about itself. But over a period of time, he could slowly change his nature. This was the effect of his sadhana applied throughout. It was an integral yoga that he practiced, a work that was done at every level of his being. He didn't stop simply because he realized the self or Brahman. He took the engine, the energy, the power of that consciousness and brought it into the field. The field of the triple gunas, the three modes of nature, and use that power to begin the process of transformation. So I think next time we'll begin with the next sentence. When the sadhak has once stood back from the action of prakriti within him or upon him, and prior to that, speak a little bit about the nature of Sankhya. In Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness, there's a section that could well be pinned to some of these insights. Beginning with the release of the consciousness from thraldom to nature. All was uncovered to his sealless eye. A secret nature, stripped of her defense, once in a dreaded half-light formidable, overtaken in her mighty privacy, lay bare to the burning splendor of his will. In shadowy chambers lit by a strange sun, and opening hardly to hid mystic keys, her perilous arcanes and hooded powers confessed the advent of a mastering mind and bore the compulsion of a time-born gaze. Incalculable in their wizard modes, immediate and invincible in the act, her secret strengths, native to greater worlds, lifted above our needy, limited scope the occult privilege of demigods and the sure power pattern of her cryptic signs, her diagrams of geometric force, her potencies of marvel-fraught design, courted employment by an earth-nursed might. A conscious nature's quick machinery, armed with a latent splendor of miracle, the prophet passion of a seeing mind, and the lightning bareness of a free soul force. All once impossible deemed could now become a natural limb of possibility, a new domain of normalcy supreme. An almighty occultist erects in space this seeming outward world which tricks the sense. He weaves his hidden threads of consciousness. He builds bodies for his shapeless energy. Out of the unformed and vacant vast, he has made his sorcery of solid images, his magic of formative number and design, the fixed irrational links none can annul, this crisscross tangle of invisible laws, his infallible rules, his covered processes, achieve unerringly an inexplicable creation where our error carves dead frames of knowledge for a living ignorance. In her mystery's moods, divorced from the Maker's laws, she too as sovereignly creates her field, her will shaping the undetermined vasts, making a finite of infinity. She too can make an order of her caprice, as if her rash superb wagered to outvie the veiled creator's cosmic secrecies. The rapid footsteps of her fantasy, amid whose falls wonders like flowers rise, are surer than reason, defter than device, and swifter than imagination's wings. All she new fashions by the thought and word compels all substance by her wand of mind. Namaste, Jai Ma.